Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, where we are dodging the word boomerangs. We want javelins. We want people throwing straight, easy to digest, easy to transparent spears at you instead of boomerangs. In other words, we're getting some better skills for talking in public and defending yourself against public talk. I am Dr. Dan, master rhetorician, PhD in rhetoric, late night comedy writer. I like to throw a lot of jokes into all of this. Founder of Rhetoric Warriors. Go to rhetoricwarriors.com. Check out, we got classes. I got a new book out, 21 Colosseums of Persuasion. Give you sort of the array of tech that you can use to persuade human beings. The podcast, we talk to comedians. I talk to comedians about their careers and politics, and I let them do uncensored jokes, which is kind of fun since they get tentative about that in clubs now because of so much blowback from the humans. I talk to outer edge political perspectives. For me, that's usually people on the right, just because I'm a comedian and I typically hang out with crazier people. And I do a little bit of conversion to try to bring everybody into the democracy ring. So we're all staying in there with each other. And I talk to rhetoricians, academics, and persuasion pros. Today's another episode of Persuasion Pros. That's a guy I met through his dad. And we had a nice conversation, sort of just a little bit of networking, and I thought it'd be interesting to bring him on. He's a freelance producer, director, and editor. He's got a degree from UT Austin, as do I, in the RTF program, I think, where I taught TV writing, but not to him. He's been out there doing it for quite a while, so we're going to talk today to Trey Stanley.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Dr. Dan.
Sure, Dr. Trey.
I wish. I didn't study that hard.
Trey's a cool name. Like, that's a good name, I think, that your dad gave you.
Yeah, it's great. It's a very Texan name, I guess. I feel like it's pretty, you hear a lot of Trays here in Texas, not outside of the state. He gave it to me. It's so funny because I'm always like, why'd you pick that name? You know, like parents spend so much time. I have three kids. You spend so much time trying to like figure out what name to give people. And their stories have never been the same. My dad and my mom, it's like, I don't know, I liked it. You're like the third generation. But I'm like, that's not even possible because
there are no other Trays anywhere near us.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but parents are just making things up.
I think like a lot of parents, you just make a decision, go with it, and then you have to justify it later on.
Well, it's pretty funny. My daughter, so we're recording this on July 14th, which is Bastille Day. And my daughter's actually in France finishing her last year of college. And her name is Quincy. And she was born on Bastille Day, and her last name is French. So every time somebody meets her in France and she says, I'm Quincy French, they think she's insane because it's kind of like saying I'm Dorothy American. And now it's Bastille Day, and that freaks them all out because she's born on their Independence Day.
Yeah.
And so, that name thing.
We probably do need more people with last name American. I mean, I don't know why. Where did that go? Like, yeah.
Yeah. Right. Are there any, like, is that a natural name or is that just like if you're a professional wrestler, I'm Dan American.
I mean, I know you can change your name. I think I might change my whole family's name to American.
It's pretty solid. I mean, the American party, reservation for the American party.
And I feel like that would really be helpful just in marketing yourself. Yeah. I'm Mr. America. I mean, literally.
Literally. Hire me for your video shoot. Hire the Americans. Nice. I like it. So let's run your background a little bit just to orient everybody. You went to UT. So were you in the RTF program?
I did a dual degree. So UT has a great RTF program. I mean, that was 20 plus years ago. So I have no idea.
How old are you?
I'm 40.
Are you really?
Yeah.
God, I would have guessed early 30s.
Oh, man. My wife and I were just like looking at pictures of us going, you look so old. So thanks. I went to, and I was also a Plan 2 major, which is such an obscure degree. I don't know if anybody who went to UT or anybody who didn't go to UT would even know what it is, but it's essentially their honors program. And I felt like I was very smart in high school. I was very sure of myself. And so I applied to a bunch of schools and didn't get into any of them. And I got into UT because at the time, I think they accepted everybody who was in the top 10% of their class. And
right,
it was, that wasn't a big stretch, I think, at the school I went to. And, but I had applied to this honors program. It's like, you know, it's like, oh, I won't go there. I'm going to go to someplace else. And yeah, so I didn't get into it either. And then, but they put me on a wait list. And right before school started, they're like, hey, if you'd like to still do the honors program, you can. And I still felt like I was, I deserved it. I was so smart, I deserved it.
You're honored. You're honorable. I'm worthy of this honor.
Yeah. So I ended up getting a degree in, Plan 2, which again, nobody knows. And I never put it on anything.
Yeah, why would you? It sounds like Plan B from outer space or something at this point.
Yeah.
I remember when I went to college, I was the first generation in my family to go to college. So I didn't know what I was doing at all. And they offered me the honors program. And I'm like, that looks like more work. Why would I want to do that? I'm here to drink beer and play rugby. And I was correct. It probably was more work.
Yeah. So yeah, Plan 2, RTF. And then I also studied Latin American studies. Because I saw that.
You did a year in Buenos Aires.
That's right. Yeah. I think that I'd always wanted to live outside the country. And so my sophomore year, I applied for a bunch of programs and scholarships. And I wanted, I don't know, maybe I'm a contrarian or something. I did not want to go to Europe. I was like, I don't want to go there. That's where all these other honors kids are going. They all want to go to Spain or Italy and spend the year there. And I was like, I'm not going to do that. So, but I still want to go to a really big city. I wanted to go to a place that had like a super vibrant film community.
Yeah, so Buenos Aires has a good tradition of film, right? Like it's a pretty strong community.
Yeah, it's great. They have a really awesome film festival once a year that's like, it's like the biggest one in South America, essentially. And just a bunch of awesome movies come from Argentina and Brazil and Chile. I mean, all over South America, but you don't get to see them often.
Yeah, I know. It's so hard to track down foreign film. Like, I don't get this. Like, Netflix throws every piece of indie junk up that they can. Why is it so hard? Is it because of rights issues that they can't grab these really good films from all these countries for, like, decades that there's not available?
I don't know. Part of it too is like Netflix makes it so hard to find movies outside of their suggested movies, because I think that a lot of them are on there, but man, if you try and get out of the lane that Netflix wants you to be in, which I experience all the time because my kids just own my Netflix,
right?
You know, so it's like a lot of Boss Babies. You know, like the Storks, and I'm like, wait, I wanted to watch this one movie or this one series, and you know, it's like might be the trending movie in America, but it's not on my feed because it's,
you know, not, it's weird movie. If you think about it, the way we raise our kids on this odd cartoonish mythology, like
super weird.
while their brains are forming, we're pumping them with, oh look, it's a talking bird and it's a you know, it's a pig that flies a spaceship. And that's just kind of weird. We're stoking them early on with fantasy instead of reality.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because when you try and get them to watch a television show with people, they have such a hard time doing it. I'll be like, hey, let's watch this. Like The Rock. I'm a big wrestling fan.
Oh yeah.
And The Rock has a TV show on right now. And so I've been trying to get my kids to watch it because they all kind of like wrestling. But they won't do it. They're like, it's boring. It's like too many human faces.
That's really interesting, man. I wonder what that does sort of long-term to the psyche of humanity. Like, we're just going to be bored with humans because they are not ducks that, you know, fly in.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, my wife is a teacher, and I know she's had a couple of strange encounters where students have only experienced animals in nature through a screen, whether it's a video game or a movie. And so she's like a big outdoors person. She loves camping and she loves bird watching. She just loves being outside. And so she'll try and she's an elementary school teacher. She'll try and bring these nature experiences to them, and they freak out because they don't know how to handle real life.
Yeah. Well, I used to make this argument with when I lived in LA, you know, it's a big,
my dog, if you can hear that, I don't know.
That's fine. It's a big hiking culture. You know, it's always, let's go hike. And I'm like, so mm-hmm. what you want me to do is head into a canyon where it hasn't rained in about, you know, 15 and a half years and walk through some kindling, and, you know, it can be lit by a heated argument and meet wildlife. Is that what you want? Because at home, I find that the remote control stops those cougars.
Yeah. Yeah, that is the argument. Where I live, it's, would you like to go for a walk and possibly encounter a alligator or a bobcat? So not, I don't know. What, is a cougar scarier than an alligator or not? Alligators are so lethargic.
Alligators have a short range of where they attack. A cougar can, you know, basically, as long as, if it wants you, it's going to get you.
Like, yeah, that's right. Gonna,
yeah.
And they can really jump far. I'll watch.
It's almost
videos.
Like they were built to hunt things. Good at it.
So yeah, they should do more of that, huh?
You ought to go with the hunting thing. Really, I think it's your thing. Okay, so Buenos Aires, and then you came back to the States, and did you start right out freelancing, or did you work some places?
That's a great question. I was technically a freelancer, although I only work, you know, so I got out of college and I worked for a post house, and they were still doing the thing where they would hire you to work more than full time, 50, 60 hours a week, but you weren't an actual employee. I'm pretty sure it violates labor laws, but that was
production.
Very common.
This is such, this industry is such a, such a scam.
So I worked at a post house, and I basically, like, I showed up to transfer a short film that I made as a student. I was like, oh, this is cool. This is better than I worked at a bar next to Waterloo Records, Waterloo Ice House in Austin. And I didn't really enjoy it, you know, it was not where I wanted to be long-term. But I went into this place and it was like, they had a beer that they gave me. They served me lunch.
they had a pool table.
They had a beautiful view of Austin. They were in right across the river from downtown. And I was like, do you guys need anybody just to like sweep your floor, fix things up, do odd jobs? Like I can be that guy for a little bit. And they're like, yeah, come on in. And so I did that for about 3 months for free. You know, I just like show up and literally whatever they needed.
I totally get it. I've done so much free work and entertainment and comedy writing and, you know, anything, you know, because
I think I just read how Kris Kristofferson did that at a studio in Nashville before he got his break. And so I was like, oh, this will be it. And, but, you know, they after the 3 months, I was like, hey, I really do need to get paid. And I feel like I'm doing a pretty good job of making myself useful. And so they hired me for $5 an hour, which is still, it was less than minimum wage. But I was like, all right, that's cool. And then I think like another 3 or 4 months in, they gave me minimum wage. And then, you know, a little bit later, they gave me $10 an hour.
All right. You're scoring.
Like, finally.
Finally, Clint Eastwood style in the, you know.
Yeah. And I became the assistant colorist there, which, you know, it was pretty cool because they still used a lot of film and I'd get to get in the dailies or the prints or whatever it was that we were transferring to video, clean it, spool it up, put it into this like giant machine that costs millions of dollars and help the colorist with whatever you needed that day.
So and have you been attracted to like So like there's, for people who don't do video or film full time, there's so many side jobs in it, small things mm-hmm. that have to be done to get it done. And you end up, you know, moving, you know, sometimes into a specialty, but you, a lot of times you're doing general stuff when you're learning. Was there something about audio or video work that attracted you, or were you attracted to the creative side? Like, does the tech interest you? Are you a tech guy, or are you a creative guy, or are you somehow both?
I would want to say that the creative interested me, but I really feel like I am probably, because I'm lazy, I'm drawn to the tech stuff because it's easier for me. And you can just like kind of knock stuff out without having to think hard. So
yeah, once you learn it, right?
It's always changing, but you can kind of like, it's like a little easier. I don't know how to explain that, but
no, it makes sense. Like I see this a lot with, and I tell people when I'm advising them, if they want a career like in Hollywood and entertainment, I'm like, learn some tech skills because those are easy hires. Mm-hmm. Creative skills are harder hires, but if you're doing tech and you have a skill set, then you can keep yourself alive. And then the creative, if you're good at it, or if you get lucky and they like you for whatever reason, then you can get into the creative. But the tech is, you know, it's a job. So if you're good at it, you can apply for work.
Yeah. And I think I was afraid, and probably to a certain extent, I was a little afraid to put myself out there creatively, you know, like that's scary. And I had a friend that was a stand-up comedian and an improv guy. And I was like, oh, that looks amazing. I want to do that. But, you know, I never had the balls or the fortitude to go out there and like actually try it. I think I tried it a couple times and just kind of made fun of him the whole time. Like this terrible friend, because I was too afraid to do that. And but yeah, and you're right. It's easy to make a living. And I was like, I've always been like pretty focused on like, okay, how do I make money? Like that's always been pretty at the forefront of like what I do. Although I say that, had I really been thinking that, I probably would have moved to LA or New York right after college, because I think that's where you can actually make money.
There's a progression up into the companies. So you get paid more and more for the same job.
Yeah, there's an industry there.
Yeah.
And I don't think that, even though I think the film program at UT is really good and was really good, I think that it had like kind of that like Texas country punk vibe to it, where everybody was kind of there because they didn't want to be part of the system.
Yeah.
And so I definitely took that ethos a little bit. I was like, I don't want to be a sellout and move to a big city where there's lots of people that love doing the same thing I do.
It's so bizarre. Like when I was teaching at UT, I knew a lot of the faculty, and I didn't stay there for very long because I'd already worked in TV and I was looking to start a production company here. So it was a side job that I did. But I had this argument with them, not an argument, but discussion a few times. I'm like, I think you're doing a disservice to your student population here because of that, because mm-hmm. they are all thinking they're Richard Rodriguez or Linkletter or whatever, and that they can forge their own path. I'm like, cool, but, you know, teach them how to survive in the industry for real, like how to really get jobs, how to really work in this stuff so that you're not basically shoving them out the door like baby birds with no wings. And I think it did hurt them in some ways, the students.
Yeah, because I think you get out and you're like, oh, I can make this work. And what I quickly encountered was that, like, you know, you meet a lot of people, like this is the early 2000s in Austin, who are, you know, it's probably the same as today. Super talented, very smart, very creative, but creative, like the creative part of the industry doesn't happen in Austin.
Right.
Or in Houston. Or anywhere outside of New York and LA. Like that's where all of those jobs are. And so if you don't live there, you don't have access to that network of people, and you're not gonna get those jobs unless you just happen to be at the right place at the right time, doing the right job, impressing the right person, you know? And so everyone was super frustrated because it's like, I'm doing this, but I really wanna be doing this.
Yeah, I saw a lot of that. And I, not to totally throw UT under the bus, they did try to build professional bridges for people to go over, and they did a lot of of work with alumni and things like that in Austin mm-hmm. to try to help them get work. But there's no comparing that to like going to UCLA and being in a classroom every day with, you know, every day you're going through classes with people that are working in the industry right then. And UT has a lot of academics and has a lot of people who used to work in the industry or tangentially mm-hmm. still in the industry, but most of the California universities out there are just directly tied into the industries.
Yeah. And I would assume like California as a state cares a lot more about that industry. Yeah, I think sure. that I'm not really sure why Texas, like the pro business state that it is like chosen to shit on the film industry and the television industry for the last 25 years. But it seems like every time I see the legislature's done something for the film industry, it actually is like not helpful.
Yeah. And I've seen that here off and on. I've been in the film community here off and on for years and years and watched the politics of it from people who are sort of on the inside. And it is that kind of the oil and gas industry and all the standard industries here going, eh, and the politicians getting capital by, you know, shitting on a California oriented industry. So film is too liberal, you know.
Yeah. Essentially, I feel like that's what's happened, right? Like,
oh yeah. They use it politically as a football.
Yeah. Louisiana, conservative as it might be, it's definitely been like, that's cool. We'll still go there.
Yeah. It's not. So yeah, it's a bastard stepchild industry here in Texas. And it's tried literally since I was here in the mid 80s, watching it, trying to, you know, grow, and they just keep pushing it back under the water.
Yeah. Yeah. So. I mean, anyways, there's just like, I was like, I don't think I want to be in advertising. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And so my girlfriend, who's now my wife, and I were talking with some friends, and they were like, hey, we're thinking about going to New Zealand. They have this working holiday program. You can go live there for a year if you're under 30 and you can work. And it'll be like hard manual labor jobs, but it should be pretty fun. And so she was in Teach for America, working for Teach for America. And I was like doing odd jobs, you know, like at this company and some other ones. And I was like, that sounds pretty cool. Let's go do it. So we ended up going to New Zealand for a year. And then
sounds like a chain gang, like you're gonna be there breaking rocks or something with sledgehammers.
Well, not quite, but I think not even close. I should say not even close. It's such a great country to hang out in. And it's like a giant island with temperate weather. Like it's kind of like if Seattle was put on Hawaii and Hawaii was the size of California.
I like it.
Yeah. I worked in apple orchards. I worked at bars. I worked at coffee shops. I did other under the table jobs.
They imported you over to work as a bartender?
They have a population of 5 million. A million people or more than a million people live overseas. And they just can't, they don't have enough people to do those jobs. Waiters, bartenders, janitors, you know, there's a bunch of handymen, but
all those jobs that the immigrants steal from us here in America.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. All those jobs that people steal from us here. Yeah, exactly. You're like, actually, I like going to restaurants. I'm pretty happy that those immigrants are here.
Yeah, they're doing a bunch of the Lord's work out there.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, so that's what we did. We bought a van, we outfitted it to camp in, we drove around for a while.
Nice.
And then we rented a house. We ended up living with those friends and another friend for like basically the whole year. And we lived on the South Island, which is the lesser populated. So it's half the size of California, less than a million people live there.
All right. So you're bopping around, man. You've been to UT, Buenos Aires, and now you're in New Zealand. You get this exotic life going. What's next? Then,
Sarah's like, my wife is like, hey, let's move. I want to be a teacher. Again, I don't have a teaching certificate. So we moved to Houston. where she knows some people in the Teach for America program that can get her into like night school so she can be a teacher.
Okay.
And we moved here in 2007. And we've been here since 2007.
So the exotic ends with Houston. You're going to go right down to the center of Texas. Although Texas still has its exoticness, right?
Galveston, Ship Channel.
Yeah, Galveston, the exotic, the enchanting isle of Galveston.
I know. It is funny to me. I always think this, that like, again, this is like one of those tourist things or like one of those promotional things, but it's like, I guess it's because they have to rebuild Galveston every 10 years, but like they're going to build this super train from Dallas to Houston. I'm like, just send it all the way down to Galveston. Like Galveston, like get tourists there a little easier. The water is not clean, but people like to go there.
Well, I mean, what choice do you have? Like you're in Texas, you got to go to, if you want to go to the beach.
Yeah.
You have a lot of choices.
Yeah. No. Yeah. So she ended up taking a job here as a teacher, and I worked at a coffee shop and was kind of meeting people. And I was like, I don't know, what do I want to do? I applied for graduate school and I was going to go back and get a, Masters of Theology.
Okay.
So I'd become a little bit more interested in religion and religious studies. I wanted to go to Rice and get a doctorate. I wanted to get a Masters of Theology and then go to Rice and get a doctorate in the psychology of religion. Like, I was just like really interested in how religion worked and like the way that people apply it in their life.
There's a lot there, man. A lot of people tend to use that stuff, I've noticed.
Yeah. And so I was there is a like small Baptist school here, and I was like, oh, I'll just get a master's of theology there. And it was okay, but it was like so restrictive. And like I would be like in a class and there'd be like, you know, 10 other guys in the class. It was all guys. And they all wanted to be preachers. And I was like the lone oddball that was like, no, I don't really want to be a professional preacher, but I do want to like study this. And they, you know, I'd be like, well, we don't think that women can preach, you know, and they'd like cite biblical references.
Have they talked to women?
Yeah, I know. And I'd be like, well, actually, like, I think it's fine. You know, so I was just that like one religious oddball.
That's funny. And, that's an extreme viewpoint in some communities.
And in the Baptist
Church. I think
maybe
women could do some of this stuff.
Yeah.
What? Are you insane?
Yeah. And I felt very strongly that, like, you know, churches should be not just open and invitational to LGBTQ people, but they should include them as, like, on their pastoral staff. Like, I just think that like not being inclusive is a real weakness in churches. And it's probably less of a hot topic, but in the middle 2000s, that was
a huge topic. That was huge. Like I taught for 2 years at a school in Raleigh, North Carolina called Peace College, like PEACE. And it was not a peaceful college. And it was founded by the church and it was run by an elder of the church, Presbyterian maybe. No, it wasn't. Anyway, and super conservative. It had been an all-female school for like 120 years. And I had a buddy who ran the communication department there. And he's like, hey man, I need somebody to set up we're starting a new department. Do you want to work here for a while? And I'm like, sure. And those 2 years, man, I set off many, many bombs in the culture by just saying ordinary things.
Yeah.
Like, hey, maybe you should let people write whatever they want to write in the newspaper. What?
So that was that was probably like the level of conservatism, or it might have been possibly more. Like, I was part of this church at the time that I thought was like pretty open-minded. It made a point of saying how open-minded it was and how inviting to people from all walks of life that it was. But pretty quickly, I was like, oh, this is just a front to get people in. The pastor ended up being, he's like a mega pastor now. At the time, it was a church of like 400 people. But he was like very like, oh no, we want to do things differently. I want to be open to everybody. But you know, they had like offices in the building that they would like give to people in the community. And one of the people was like, oh yeah, I'm like here to help prostitutes. And it was like the neighborhood that we lived in is Montrose in
Houston. I know that neighborhood. I used to do stand up right around there.
Yeah.
The comedy
cellar, right?
No, it wasn't the cellar. It was the, I don't know, comedy something.
It closed the first year that I moved here. No, I was like kind of bummed out because I think that there's like a couple of comedy albums that were recorded there.
Yeah, Houston had a huge stand-up scene. I mean, with Sam Kennison and Hicks was out of there for a while. They had a bunch of energy coming out of Houston for quite a while.
Yeah. But then it turned out that it was like a gay conversion ministry. And I was like, what? That's weird. And then the pastor did
converting people towards being gay, right? Like it's grabbing heteros and being like...
They're like, have you enjoyed this yet?
You never hear about those, man. They never get into the media.
Never get coverage. Not once. I don't know. There's like a couple of other weird moments. And I was like, this is like, I don't know. It like really soured me. And then I was still working at a coffee shop and I met this guy. He was pretty cool. And he ended up being the like director of broadcast ministries for the ultimate mega church pastor in Houston, which is Joel Osteen. And he was like, hey, you seem like you might like you're in churches, you're gonna do da, da, da. Why don't you come check out our facility? Like I was like, I don't know, I've never even like heard of like working for a broadcast ministry. This is a super weird world. And I think that like it just felt super. Like it conflated two things that shouldn't be conflated.
Right. That's interesting. Yeah.
But I went there and he was awesome. And the people that worked there were pretty cool. And then like they had a pretty cool setup. There was like an 8-camera studio. That's a 16,000 seat church. The church is a television studio. It's like acoustically treated. It's got mics everywhere. It's got, millions and millions and millions of dollars of broadcast equipment in it. You know, it's got the best 4K Sony cameras.
Just imagine how good the Sermon on the Mount would have been.
So much better.
If Jesus had some production value.
Some 50-foot jits.
If he'd have just made one decent handheld phone video.
I know. So anyways, I was like, I don't know. This seems pretty cool. Like it's like, I'm pretty disillusioned with the church I was going to. I was pretty disillusioned with the Masters of Theology program. And I was kind of tired of working at the coffee shop. And I was like, yeah, I'll go do this for a little bit. And then, so it wasn't like a full-time job. But then it quickly became one, you know, and then they offered me a full-time job and I had like healthcare, all the things that you want to have. And my wife and I were like ready to have our first kid. It seemed like, oh, this is like a super stable thing to do. And it was like a super stable job.
I don't know, man. I think that Christianity thing could be a flash in the pan.
Yeah, I know. And I ended up working there for 11 years. I started off as like an editor and became a producer. And then I was a director of the television show for a while until I left. And I got to experience television ministry in all of its glory.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I was interested in talking to you. I told you, because we talked a little bit about this because you're a wrestling fan, that I interviewed my buddy Eddie Feldman, who produced WWE for 2 or 3 years.
Okay.
And that's not something that people normally think of either as like a just a big film, you know, video TV production environment. But they had to write the storylines, they had to practice, you know, they had to do all this stuff. And they had maybe 30 writers because there's so many storylines going on and things having to be constantly reevaluated. So when you see broadcasts and all the techniques of production come into different worlds, it's really kind of fascinating. And, you know, when it drops into religion, like I grew up, my grandmother, you know, backwoods Indiana, fifth grade education. And just, she just loved that stuff. She loved Jimmy Swaggart and Pat Robertson and, you know, the television ministries. And so it was a big part of when I was growing up, when I would go over there, it was always around.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, people do love it, especially old people. Old people love television ministries. It's the bulk of the people who, so yeah, it's like, it's essentially a subscription model, but it's called giving. But so old people love to give to television ministries. It's the bulk of the people that keep it supportive.
Why do you think that is? Do you have any theories on that?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like maybe in like 30 years, I could tell you what it feels like to be.
Well, you're getting close to death. So you're trying to buy some real estate in heaven, right?
Yeah. And I think it's an easy way to feel responsible. Like you're able to do good, you know, because I think that's probably the bigger thing is like, at least at Joel Osteen Ministries, the way that you market it is like, hey, why don't you give to help people out? I think you know, one of the phrases that got reused all the time was like, I'm blessed to be a giver. I'm blessed to be a blessing to others. And so that idea that you can really help out other people who have a lot less than you by participating in this ministry. And it's super simple. You literally just have to write a $50 check a month. And, you know, you're able to like help people in need.
One of the cool things too, and I like that you're talking about how it brings together these two worlds again, like it's got a big aura to it. It's got a big production to it. So you are buying your way sort of into that feeling too. You're not just giving money, you know, at the corner church and then it's gone. You get to see this whole thing that you're kind of funding.
Yeah. And the idea that someone said, like, I think in America, we really value financial success. And obviously like with social media, you see it all the time. Like people who are famous for being famous are both financially rewarded and looked up to. And so I think just being famous, being known is sort of a, to a lot of people, I don't know if they'd necessarily put it this way unless they were religious. And even if they're religious, they might not say it, but it's a conduit to heaven or to God. You know, like it's the same way that like I think the Catholic Church kind of sees the Pope as being the conduit to God. You know, if you're not Catholic, well, this television minister or this celebrity is like, you know, in a way holy.
Well, and it does. It gives that kind of, in America, you know, we're all trained to be capitalists. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I like about Osteen, just from the general perspective of what he's doing, is that he has been able to merge the American capitalism and the American Christian, the traditional Christian.
Yeah.
You know, he can hold both those personas together fairly well in one person. And that's not easy.
No. The other thing I think that he is super, it's both something that he gets criticized for, but I think it's actually like the point of it's maybe one reason why he's so successful. Is he doesn't focus his time on, I mean, if you've gone to church, ministers will often spend a lot of time going, hey, we're going to talk about 2 Corinthians for the next 6 weeks. I'm going to break down 2 Corinthians.
I'm going to break it down.
Yeah. You know, we're going to go through, I guess it's called exegesis. We're going to do a line by line exegesis of this book. And look, there's my daughter.
Hello, daughter. Hey, hi.
This is Stella.
Hi, Stella.
Can we watch something?
No. Yeah. Keep playing.
Hannah wants to.
Well, tell her no, and I will come down and help you out in a little bit, okay?
Bye, Stella.
Want to watch the TV? Yeah.
See what you're doing to the kids? Producing all your demon video and...
but so he, yeah, he like doesn't do that. Everything is a parable. He tells super simple stories about people who were in trouble and then how they were healed, helped, or some other version of having their problem solved. And he tells those stories for about 25 minutes. And I think that like it makes the idea that there is a being that's out there that's looking after us, or at least wants good for us. It makes it very clear. And so people really, really, really connect to it, especially at first. I don't know if people stay in the church for a long time. But some people do, and some people are like, oh, this is like really great. And I want to listen to it for a little bit. I want to listen to it all the time. He has his own SiriusXM channel where you can listen to him 24/7.
Wow.
I think that is, to me, the biggest difference. Because I've gone to, at this point in my life, I went from never going to church, then having sort of like a church conversion experience and started going to church, and then being part of this church. And because I was part of this church, I had to go to a lot of other churches and do all kinds of other things. And that I would say that's his biggest strength. And that's what people respond to. It's just how simple it is. But because it's so simple, he gets hammered all the time. You're not actually being a Christian. You're not really properly educating people on like the word of the Bible, which is like a big thing for evangelicals. Like the Bible is almost more important to them than anything else. And it's following the words in that book, So that's super, as someone who just like is interested in sort of like theology, it's super interesting to me because he kind of like plays with it a lot. Never in anything that's like would violate the tenets of evangelicalism, mm-hmm. but because he doesn't do it in like the way that people would want him to do it, he gets like, it's, pastors are petty, man. They'll say some pretty nasty remarks behind backs, and they're all friends. Like they all call each other, all these like big pastors, but they all take shots at each other in magazine interviews and stuff. So.
Yeah, it's all competitive, right? You're all competing for the same thing, which is followers, so there's a competitive nature in it. And I'm sure there's ego in it about who's the best at it and all that good stuff.
And television ratings.
Sure.
Like they all compete for who's the number one pastor on the main network is Trinity Broadcast Network. And so they all want to be like, who's the number one on that?
So with his stories, from a production standpoint, did he write his own stories or did he have a writing staff or?
That part's always very like, what I always understood it to be was he wrote everything.
Did he show up on his back porch and they were there in the morning, have been written by angels? That'd be the story right there.
That would be. No, it was that he locked himself into his office Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. He spent all day Friday memorizing it. And then Saturday we would do the dress rehearsal service. And then Sunday morning, there was two services. And the first one was like, we could, if we needed to, if he said things better or more clearly in the first service, we could go back and edit that into the 11 o'clock service, which was the main one that we used for that's on television.
Like stand up, like when they do a stand up special, they'll tape it at least two times, sometimes four times over a weekend and then intercut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So they would use two, and the 11 o'clock service would be the main one, mostly because it had the biggest audience, the most people that went to church at that time. So you could really use the cameras in the most effective way to tell, you know, because a big part of the story of that church is just how many people show up each weekend.
Right.
Like when you go there, it's like you're part of 16,000 people that are worshiping God. And that's a very powerful feeling if worshiping God is like something that's important to you.
Yeah. I can't tell you how many times I've had independent, like indie, non-Hollywood people want to do a talk show or something and say, oh, we don't want to deal with a live audience. And me go, yeah, well then you don't want a talk show because that energy, not being in the room, no way. You have to have human energy.
Yeah. Yeah. It really helps everybody. And it's really appealing because you want to be part of something that other people are part of. I mean, just intrinsically, we all want to be doing the thing that everybody else is doing.
And Olsen seems to have, I mean, he has some chops. Like he's a really decent actor and, you know, guy on camera. Like it's repetitive. There's not a lot of variety to it, but he shows emotion. He seems like, is he working off prompter, I assume?
No. That might have changed this year because during the pandemic, there's no audience. But I still have friends that work there, but the whole time I worked there, no, he had everything memorized. He kind of has a photographic memory.
That's pretty useful.
Yeah. Secret strengths. His story is pretty cool. He was the behind the scenes guy for his dad for 20 years. So he helped his dad start a television ministry in the late 70s and early 80s. And the whole family is pretty, and there's a really big there was a really big pastor named Oral Roberts.
Oh yeah.
In Tulsa.
God, there's a great Houston stand-up named Ron Schock who has the best bit about Oral Roberts.
Well, I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what the bit in when you finish here.
Oh, well, they were just super into, I mean, that church is the church that most of the people I met at Lakewood, which is his church, that's the church school that they send their kids to. So like the people are really into it. It's that portion of the evangelical faith. I think there's like Baylor's for Baptists, Oral Roberts for kind of like charismatic Christians, which is people who are like believe in being filled with the Spirit, which translates to like talk in tongues and believe in healing miracles.
Right.
And then, I think Liberty University is the other big one for evangelicals. And that's more for like Southern Baptists or independent churches that are very conservative. And there's a lot of other ones, but I think those are the three big ones that I, at least in like people I've met, send their kids to. And another one is obviously Notre Dame, if you're Catholic.
It sounds weird to put Notre Dame in the middle of those others.
Sure.
I guess because Notre Dame is so much more in the, you know, zeitgeist of the big culture because of football.
Yeah. And it's been around for so long. It's been an excellent, I think it probably is still an excellent university. I think typically I'll meet people who've gone there and they're very smart and had to study very hard to earn their degrees.
Yeah. It's very Harvard. Like I played rugby against Notre Dame. So I went up there a couple of times and so I come from working class Kentucky, like very blue collar.
Yeah.
And going up to Notre Dame, they were like my antithesis. They were they were so snotty and, you know, like, oh, in power, you know, and I'm like, no, we are not of the same.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I feel that way about Baylor too. I always feel like people who go to Baylor are very like high class.
Yeah.
Or like ooh la la.
It's weird that class gets, you know, soaked into everything and nobody really talks about class in America anymore. They talk about race and they talk about gender and they talk about religion and whatever, but we kind of dropped class from the discussion after around the 70s, I think. And people are like, or the 60s, people are like, let's talk about all these other things. But it's always there. It's like you were talking earlier about, you know, people trying to one-up each other, even as pastors. mm-hmm. which is, you know, it's always a form of I'm a higher class than you are. You're a lower class aesthetically than we are and all that stuff. So,
yeah, for sure. I know that, like, this is totally off topic, but growing up in Austin is so nice and it's like so educated, and it's just it is a very fancy city, especially for Texas, even if it's not as fancy as, like, you know, the nicest neighborhood in Dallas or the nicest neighborhood in Houston, because probably not quite the same level of money. But like in my head, I always, like, one of the things that I always held me back from ever considering going to Houston, like, I don't think I'd ever been to Houston until we moved here, was just because I felt like it was like a kind of a dirty and
yeah it's all right, it's
like it's lower class city.
It's got everything.
Yeah
I like actually like Houston, but I've been there many, many times for stand-up, and I used to explore the city, and sometimes I'd be in a good area with a comedy club and sometimes in a bad area, but
yeah,
it was always fun. There's so much to do there.
Yeah. But yeah, I definitely had like a class-based assumption about Houston that made me not want to go visit it, which, you know, turned out to be not true at all. But that's what most assumptions are, I'm sure.
So you kind of progressed up through that TV ministry, right? You started as a editor and then moved up producer and then you ended up directing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was pretty fun. And yeah, I mean, like, I got along with everybody, and it was like, I say that, and this is like one of those things where, like, when you start doing jobs and making a career, it's almost like your career path is sometimes shaped by your circumstances. So I think up until then, I had done sort of a mix of creative stuff and technical stuff. But in this ministry, at least, it's like all technical, very little creative, because there was a creative producer. And he did the opens and the closes and the interstitials. And he was kind of like he could direct live action stuff, but he was also a great motion graphics artist. So he did all of that stuff. And then everything else, I mean, Joel was basically the director of the show.
Yeah, it sounds like he was the whole creative team.
I want it this way, I want it this way, the lighting, you know, and towards the end of my time at the ministry, he brought in a few other people to help him out who helped him out to some degree, I think. But for the most part, he's still super hands-on and, like, I would say probably micromanaging, you know? Like, I would create videos for him when I was an editor, and he would need to watch it several times, and, you know, he had little things. And before we even sent it to him, my boss, who has worked for Joel his whole life, you know, would, like, he knew how his boss operated. And so he was like, oh, we need to do this, we need to do this, we need to do this. And so, yeah, like, very technical job. A lot of the creative decisions are taken out of your hands. You know, you're not doing that. And there isn't sort of like a creative team that decides on anything. There's a creative team that decides on, like, sort of technical stuff. And
I mean, it's kind of a creative dictatorial environment, right? Like, that's one of the things I think when you are the star of something, and if you like doing, you know, production and you want to take direct, you know, a direct role and stuff like that, then there's no reason for you not to kind of control all that and set the levels and say, this is what I want. And then just people do it for you.
Yeah. And I think that when I got there, I thought that it was going to be closer to sort of like a variety show. And I think a better way to think about what I was doing, at least by the time I left, was it was a live event show. So more like a touring band. And so, because a lot of the creative input is in, like, lighting design, sort of like background videos during the music portion of the service.
Right.
And sort of like how it comes across to the audience. And so that was like one of the things that I felt like I learned the most. It's just like how, when you do a live event, how on you have to be to all these details. I think having only been in, like, one variety of, like film and video production or post-production, like, I don't think you don't think about how the audience perceives it necessarily. Like, it's kind of out of your control.
Right.
Or like it shows in a theater and like, you're not doing, you know, no, you know, that's the theater's job. And so, yeah, you're like there, you're in charge of the theater and you're in charge of making sure that it looks awesome and there's smoke and there's cool lights and it doesn't get boring.
Yeah. And there's that sense of you are curating that experience for the next audience, which is the, you know, the media audience, right? You're trying to get as much of that live experience in there as possible. Mm-hmm. I would expect, and augment it with, you know, all the technology and camera angles and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I always thought it was super interesting just from like a financial point of view, because all of the money at churches goes into the music, which is the worship, they call it worship. So the worship portion of the service, that's where the lights go. That's where the, like, you know, there's eight people on stage typically or more. There's like four worship leaders and six band members. And they're all very accomplished professionals. They're not creating those songs. Like, there's like probably 10 writers of Christian music that are probably billionaires. And like, it's not a joke. They often like appear on interviews or whatever from their yachts in Italy. You know, they're just like wildly successful. And everyone else in sort of this like Christian world, they sing their songs. At least that's how it's evolved too.
And interesting niche, man. I may have to start writing some Christian music.
You should. Definitely the only like, what are those fancy American Express cards? The black card or whatever that's just like onyx. It's like literally, you know, I've only seen them a few times and it's always like a very well-to-do Christian rock star.
Interesting.
Yeah. But yeah, so all of the money for the services goes to that. Cause it's like, you know, once the pastor starts, just kicked over my modem. Once the pastor starts speaking, you know, it's a very basic lighting setup. The stage isn't changing. If you do a television show, at least Joel wants his television show to always look the same. Right. So the background changes very rarely. And so it's just, yeah, it's crazy how much money and time and effort goes into that first, the first half of the service. And because the first half of the service isn't for broadcast, you know, it's like no one outside of the audience is going to see it. That's there live. I think that some version of it makes it to television, but you know, like out of the millions of people that watch Joel, like I think it's in the thousands, it's like not tens of thousands, it's thousands of people watch it a week, the music portion of the service.
Interesting. So is there an aesthetic that has kind of evolved over time about how to shoot it? Because I see this a lot in stand-up specials. They struggle to figure out how to shoot the close-ups versus the wide shots and long shots, because it needs to be really, if they did it correctly, they would do a tight rehearsal and cut on, you know, they would close up on the jokes and the facial expressions and they would cut into it and the angles and all that. There's not a really good there's really not an aesthetic psychology of how they cut it. It's not done very well. So is there?
I've often thought that like comedians should hire church directors to direct their specials.
That's what it sounds like. Yeah.
Because we spend a lot of time thinking about the best way to showcase between the audience and the speaker and to bounce between that and when the right time is and when to move the camera. You know, I mean, it's important to show the wide audience, but you don't want to show that very often. You definitely want to like be on a closer up for, you know, for pastors, they're pretty funny usually, but they have a lot of emotion, a lot more emotion than a stand-up would. But yeah, I mean, you want to be on, I would think that you would want to be on a stand-up for at least the part of their joke where their face is reacting to the joke, if that's something that they do. And I think for pastors, you want to be on them when they kind of are like right at that moment when they are letting you have this like truth that they want to express to you. And that's usually when they get the most emotional. But yeah, I mean, we would have a medium wide shot that kind of was, you know, it's always on a zoom lens and it kind of pushes in. And then the tight shot, one thing that distinguishes Joel from other pastors is he really wants a super tight shot.
Yeah, so I've noticed that. That's what when I think of him, that's what I'm thinking of. Yeah.
Is this, whereas most pastors would like have it a little bit, you know, people don't want to have their face that big on the screen. But no, he it's really important to him, and he will let you know if he thinks you're being, if you're not tight enough, you know. He's kind of like watching the screen the whole time. And he has an assistant that watches the screen as well and will like text you during the service while he's on stage, like, hey man, you need to be closer.
So is he given direction during the show, or is that just the assistant knowing?
During the live shows, he would give direction. And then the assistant during the like church services is kind of like giving, if there's any notes, he'd be giving the notes. Yeah. But his assistant has worked for him for like his entire career.
Right.
Like Joel's entire career in broadcast. His assistant named Johnny has been sort of that right-hand role. And so he knows that, you know, it feels like he knows what Joel's thinking at the same time that Joel would think it. So.
Yeah. I don't think people understand that sometimes, like again, in talk shows, there's always a head writer and an executive producer. And usually it's the executive producer who's the closest to the talent. The head mm-hmm. writer's close too, but the executive producer is on stage, you know, directing. There's a director, but the executive producer is there kind of monitoring everything. And you can even see the talent throwing jokes at the exec producer. Letterman used to make it obvious, you know, he'd pull them in, but they've always got that rapport going yeah. with that person that they trust and they know. And so they're doing the show in a way for them, at least partly. And it gives it that intimacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, that's for the talent. It's super important to have a person that you can trust there, because obviously, I mean, that's a lot of pressure, you know, week in, week out to be in front of people and to deliver. And, you know, I don't think you would say entertain at a church, but I think it would be, you'd say probably something like to deliver God's word or to
entertainingly entertainments, the gods of entertainment.
Well, it's funny because there's a lot of like things that you wouldn't openly discuss, you know, you don't want to discuss like, oh yeah, people just like show up and they like to hear you speak. Like it's entertaining. You know, it's like, well, no, like you would say something like, you know, God's delivering a, you know, God's message is really like coming through you this week.
So when you work there, do you have to translate the production and all that terminology more into that type of community lingo, that vocabulary?
No, I mean, everyone on the production team is like, everyone on the production team is like, yeah. Like,
okay.
We're all on the same page.
That'd be weird to have to do that with everything. Like God wants to get nearer to you, you know?
Yeah, totally. And cause there's a lot of like churches use a lot of volunteers. People really like to be part behind the scenes, you know? And so with the volunteers, you do have to like help them understand what you're saying. And like, as with all production people, you know, when you know how the thing is made and when you see it so often, you kind of start to become a little sarcastic. And so you have to like temper that a little bit and introduce them to the fact like, no, we really do care about this, but we are going to like, you know, make jokes as well. Like we're people, like we need to keep it interesting. And I don't know if we would make jokes about Joel or any of the other pastors necessarily, but a lot of the people who show up, you know, like there'd be people that would show up in the same place every week, and they would, you know, they would be, to us, they'd be characters that we'd want to showcase. You know, we'd give them names. We would alert each other like, hey, like one of my favorite characters, we called him Cowboy, because he always showed up with a giant cowboy hat, and he would start headbanging in the middle of the service, you know, like holding the cowboy hat, just like going for it. We're like, cowboy's at it. Go get cowboy, you know.
That's great. Yeah, I think that's one of the things I like about production is all that nuance behind the scene. You start to see flavor and you start to see what you can use. And again, it's not something that people from the outside, if you've never been inside that, you don't watch people making the sausage and adding the fennel seed, you know, mm-hmm. into the sausage. But when you're in that mix and you find good things, it's just like a gift, right?
Yeah.
Dog's going like crazy. That dog effect that I'm adding right now.
Yeah, thanks for adding that. Yeah, yeah, this is so cool.
I like to flavor things with a little bit of animal noise now and then. Well, that's super cool, man. That's, you know, it's fun to hear, like I said, persuasion pros who have had specific, you know, experiences using their talent and their skills and their training in interesting environments. And anytime I find something like that, I always want to bring them on and just kind of glean what that's like in that environment. Yeah.
No, it's super fun. I mean, working in production is super fun. Working on a show is super fun where you get to like develop relationships. Cause I think that's the biggest thing about doing a show versus sort of like one-off projects is like you get to meet people on one-off projects. You might be with them for several weeks or months if it's a bigger project, but then you're done. And unless it's someone that you work with quite a bit, you're probably not going to see them ever again. You might not see them for several years. You might only see them once or twice a year at big events that everyone would go to. And so at a show, right, you get really close to there's like 25 core crew members that, you know, basically work together for, you know, at least several years, some people longer. You know, I worked there for 11 years and other people worked there for longer. I was on the longer side. Most people left a little bit, you know, didn't work there for quite as long, but yeah, it was great. I loved it.
Yeah. I always thought it was interesting when I worked on shows, when we got canceled and so it was 100, 125 people all in the same environment, like you said, for years and over again. And then one day, oh, we got canceled. Everybody's like, what? And it's like a city disbanding.
Yeah.
And within 2 or 3 days, everything's gone.
Totally. And you're there for so long. And then all the relationships just kind of dissolve.
Yeah, you know, they do. There's no way to keep those together for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, cool, man. I really appreciate you jumping on. Like I said, super interesting. And I appreciate your time.
No
anything
problem.
You're promoting, you want to, anybody can the trace.
Yeah. I have a website, TreyAustinStanley.com. And then I have basically since I left there, I've started a business where I help businesses tell their stories in a more effective way. I feel like I learned a lot on how to like tell a story, a really complicated story in a really short amount of time. And so I feel like I have like a real skill that I'm able to help people with their stories. And that company is called Listed Media, listed.media. Listed.com was taken. So I'm on the listed.media. But yeah, that's what I do. I live in Houston. I live in Sugar Land. So mostly it's energy companies. It's like kind of the industry here.
Right.
That I've gotten into. I'm sure there's a lot of other industries. Houston's a huge city. But yeah, so yeah, people want to do that. And then the other thing I do is I just get like hired to like by friends who left the church, and I'm a pretty good camera op or field producer. So they'll sometimes just bring me in and whatever crazy projects they're doing, get to go work on those.
Yeah. That is the life of the production person, right?
Just, mm-hmm.
You know, kind of bop into the crazy this, crazy that.
Yeah.
I see a lot of it in Austin. I got a buddy here who's a location scout and an location manager. And he came to my house once and he's like, hey, is this house available? I'm like, yeah, you could. So he threw it in a movie, you know, and
that's cool.
Every once in a while, my kids will watch the movie. I think it's called Band Camp or something.
Okay.
And they're like, there's our house.
That's great.
Yeah, it's super fun. But all right, man. Well, again, one
more thing. The other thing that I do is I do improv comedy. Like about when I left the church, I decided that I wanted to start trying the stuff that I'd always been too afraid to do. And so, yeah, like I perform Wednesday nights at the Continental Club with, you know, some other improv comedians. So if people are ever in Houston, want to come hang out, I'll probably be there.
There you go. Go see Trey doing some live comedy created in the moment by the improv friendly cult that it is.
So awkward to have people come hang out. You're like, I'm sorry you had to sit through that.
I've had friends come to stand-up shows, and like every once in a while, like it's just a bad experience. Like I had a friend who brought her boyfriend. He got so drunk he couldn't even sit in his chair and he was falling. And I'm like, really? I said, y'all can't, you're my friend. You can't come and heckle. You can't be a problem when I get you in free. That's not allowed.
Yeah, that's, you're like, you're supposed to be supportive. Yeah, he was the toughest one to talk to.
He was literally turning around to talk to yell to people in the back of the room. Oh my God. Have him kicked out. I'm like, I'll kick her out first and then drag him out afterwards.
Oh man. So let me ask you this before, you know, this could be over, but how did you learn how to write a joke? I feel like that's like something that I think about all the time. And I'm like, it still kind of eludes me. I'm not a very funny person. I'm like, or maybe I'm like too technical. And I'm like, I want to know the in and the out. Like when you have an idea of it, and then you kind of think about it and you start playing around with it. And are your jokes like one-liners, or are they kind of like longer stories?
I've been in it so long that I write a big range of comedy. Like, and typically the way you learn it is by watching somebody do it.
Yeah.
And then you go, well, what'd they do? And just abstract the technique. Like I've got a buddy, Peter Charkalis, who I've actually had on the podcast, who's a great little monologue writer, but he really writes one kind of joke over and over again. He's worked for 20 years in Hollywood, 25 years. And it's all the same thing. It's a bait and switch, one word replacement joke. So like one of his jokes way back in the day was, there's a gay stoner movie coming out. It's called Dude, Where's My Dude? So the joke is all the same semantically until you get to that last word. Mm-hmm. And if you shift everything at that last word, it creates this huge psychological cascade.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you like wake up a lot in the middle of the night with like, oh, that's a funny.
I used to. I write everything down. Like my work structures, I'll do intellectual stuff during the day. And then when I get overloaded with actually thinking, I'll just write jokes. Like my Twitter feed at Rhetoric War is just jokes. I'll write 10, 12 jokes a day.
All right.
And that's just fun for me. It's a way to relax my brain.
Yeah.
So all it's right, really, I think it's really just getting in and absorbing it and watching it with a focus towards learning the techniques that are going on.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like, because I, you know, since I started doing that, I start writing jokes, and you can't really use them in improv, but it's good to have them in the back pocket because you can like sometimes.
Yeah, suddenly you seem like a genius.
Well, mostly you set it up and then someone ruins it.
Yeah. No, that's why I don't like improv. You got to rely on others.
It's so difficult. But yes. All right. I'll listen to that podcast.
Okay.
And, cool. I mean, I listened to a lot of other ones too, but. Yeah, I'm always like curious. I'm like people get so good at writing jokes and being funny. And yeah, I was always too earnest.
Partly it's the brain. Like if your brain is, if you're an abstractor, you're an absurdist, you know, your brain will kind of be drawn to that stuff. But a lot of comedy writing is just mechanical technique. There are very strong mechanical techniques that turn things into comedy.
Yeah.
If you learn the list of 50 techniques, like I used to have a list of techniques on my wall when I was a staff writer. And if I would be having trouble thinking of something, I'd just look over and go, oh yeah, I can just do the two story connecting at the end technique, which is David Letterman's. Like when I wrote for Letterman, his major structure was take two different disparate news stories and crash them together at the last minute. So like an example of that, he got to where he liked a lot of image punchlines. So this is when Sotomayor was getting, this Latino woman was getting confirmed as a Supreme Court justice. And at the same time, Lance Armstrong was winning his sixth Tour de France. And so the joke was, Sotomayor, man, she's sailing through this process, but I think she may be getting a little overconfident. Look how she showed up today at the hearing. And it was her in a yellow jersey. And so like he does two stories crashing together jokes. And if you watch Letterman, 70% of the jokes are that.
Okay. Huh. That's super interesting.
Yeah. So it's all, it's mechanical technique. Every once in a while I'll teach a comedy writing workshop where I kind of list the techniques and help people practice them, but it's, yeah, it's a lot of it's just mechanics.
Yeah. Yeah. The improv stuff I do, it's basically like you said, writing jokes is relaxing. It's just like the hobby that I do, you know, yeah. It's like, I go to it, I hang out with some people. I try and be silly and funny. Some nights I'm more successful than others. And then at the end of the night, I just like feel super refreshed.
Yeah. It's nice to just let your brain have that permission, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I think so, comedy is a ministry is what I'm trying to say, Trey. It's come to the comedy church and give money to the comedians because they're in touch with the comedy spirit.
I mean, the setup for a lot of improv stuff is surprisingly similar to churches too.
Sure.
You gotta like show up and take classes. You gotta give money. Yeah, you gotta get really cult-y. Involved in the community.
I love improv people, but it's very culty. Stand-up is just a loner walking into the room, sitting in the back until they're allowed to go on stage and dominate the room. So, very different orientations.
Yeah.
Well, go check out Trey's stuff. Go out to listed.media, hire him for things. He's in Houston. He does good work. Once again, appreciate it. This has been Rhetoric Warriors. Get out there and persuade some people. As always, they need it.